Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 15th of April, these are our main stories. A year after Sudan's civil war began, an international conference has opened in France to raise humanitarian aid and find ways to end the conflict. As world leaders urge restraint from Israel after the Iranian attacks at the weekend, Tehran calls them an act of self-defence. Also in this podcast.
When I was lying there on the ground bleeding profusely, I found myself idiotically thinking, oh, that's my nice suit's about to be ruined.
2 years on, we hear from the author Salman Rushdie on the attack that left him without sight in one eye. All that and a new report tells us why adults with COVID suffer far more than children. Since civil war broke out in Sudan exactly a year ago today, almost 9 million people have been displaced. The conflict between the government forces and a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces is as intense as ever and is creating what the UN says could become the world's largest hunger crisis. At an international conference in Paris aimed at boosting aid for Sudan, the French Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné said the Sudanese people had been victims of indifference and a wall of silence around the conflict.
La tâche d'ailleurs est colossale. Si je donne quelques chiffres.
The task is huge. Let me give you some figures for this crisis. 27 million Sudanese, which is more than half of the population, are in need of humanitarian aid. Some 15 million of those are children. 18 million of them are in situations of acute food insecurity, facing famine. And over 8 million people have had to leave their homes and are therefore displaced.
The US Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, says the civil war has triggered waves of killings and brought the country to the brink of famine.
The international community needs to step up with more humanitarian aid. We appreciate that the French are gathering donors. We've seen only 5% of the need met at a time we're headed into the rainy season and the lean season. So one thing is we really just need the world to get that aid directly to the camps outside and to address the humanitarian access issues. But ultimately, the real thing that the Sudanese people want and the only thing that will ultimately address the humanitarian crisis is to end the war.
I asked our Africa correspondent Barbara Pledasha how much things had deteriorated for people in Sudan over the past year.
The women and children, of course, are the most vulnerable populations. And so there have been a study, for example, in one refugee camp in northern Darfur to see how much they were affected by malnutrition. And the results were that a third of children under five and of pregnant women and new mothers, which is a staggering amount. It's something that already Sudan had been fragile before the war, but this has really upped the stakes of the need there. And this is compounded by, you know, the complete collapse of so many things. The collapse of state services, the economy has been ruined in many areas, so Sudan can't produce its own food anymore. Many of the people have been displaced and are in camps like the one I mentioned, but they get almost no access to aid. The army is accused of blocking access across conflict lines. The rapid support forces are accused of looting supplies. And there's just not nearly enough of the aid either. 6%, that is the amount that the UN's appeal has been met so far, and that will be one of the key focuses of the conference in Paris.
So these people in Paris, do they have the power to change the situation, get more aid in? What leverage do they have over these armed groups that aren't letting the aid in anyway?
Well, if you look at the past year and especially the past months, they don't seem to have that much leverage at all, because they have been pressing for aid to be able to get in. Now, they can make a difference in terms of how much is available and how much money is used. But in terms of getting the access to it, that depends on, to a large degree, to the army, which had been blocking aid into areas controlled by the Rapid Support Forces because it wanted to stop any weapons from getting through, it said. But that has also severely affected access for aid. So there will be pressure also put on the parties to respond. And this conference has brought together representatives from Sudan's neighbors, from Gulf Arab nations, from Western powers, as well as the UN and humanitarian actors, and that it wants to send a strong message to the warring parties to allow the aid and to end the conflict. And I think also just to sort of send a message to wake up the world. As you were mentioning, Sudan has not been getting that much attention and they want to move it to the top of the agenda.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Iran has sought to justify its unprecedented attack on Israel. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the strikes were a limited act of self-defence and that Western countries should appreciate Iran's restraint. Israel's allies have urged it to avoid any escalation. Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, called for calm. She warned that Tehran had led the Middle East to the edge of the abyss. The British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, told the BBC Israel needed to think with its head, not its heart.
I can understand how every Israeli this morning would think, you know, we must respond, we have a right to respond, and they do have a right to respond, but I think the smart and tough thing to do is to actually, as Biden put it, you know, take the win. This has been a failure for Iran. Now let's focus on Gaza and let's focus on Hamas, because, of course, Israel have now offered Hamas a deal.
David Mentzer is an Israeli government spokesperson. He told the BBC that his country had the right to defend itself.
We are, at the very essence, not a war-seeking nation. You know, on Saturday night, Israelis spent a night, mums, dads, kids, in and out of bomb shelters in our country. Israel must be able to defend itself, and it will, both defensively and offensively. Israel, whose first objective is to protect its own citizens, we will be defended.
Our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, considers how Israel might proceed.
Israel hasn't come out with a formal response despite its war cabinet meeting for quite a long time yesterday. It's said to favour hitting back at Iran, but it's divided about when and how it should do so. The Israeli military, we understand, has been drawing up a whole list of different possible options. But when it comes to weighing a response, you know, you've got on the far right some ministers like the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir saying Israel should go berserk to restore Israeli deterrence in the region. You've got the Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich saying he'll use his full influence to make sure Israel retaliates for the Iranian attack. And the argument really here is that Iran has crossed a red line. If it's not dealt with in a especially sort of powerful way, it will do so again. But then you have key voices in the war cabinet. I think important to look at the comments that have come out from them, from the Defence Minister Yoav Gallant, from the centrist Benny Gantz, who were with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, that the three key decision makers in that war cabinet, they've been talking in a bit more of a balanced way about the opportunity to strengthen the strategic alliance against the threat from Iran. And you get the sense that they really see an opportunity here to reset international relations after heavy criticism over Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza. And I think through the day, they're going to be hearing more and more from Israel's international allies about the need for restraint. We've had Lord Cameron there talking about the need for a smart and tough response. The British Prime Minister is expected to speak later, but they're also expecting visits in the days ahead from the likes of Lord Cameron and from other foreign officials as well, according to Israeli media.
Yolan Nell there. And in a special episode of the Global News podcast, we're going to be answering your questions on the current Iran-Israel conflict. You can get in touch and send yours by emailing us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. To India now, where the largest democracy in the world is about to be gripped by election fever. Voting starts on Friday and almost a billion people are registered to head to the polls. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is bidding for a third consecutive term in office. But what will he need to do to win over young voters? The BBC's James Kumarasamy is in the south of the country, in Bengaluru, to meet four students who will be voting for the first time.
So I'm at St. Joseph's University in the centre of Bengaluru, and we're in the shade of a rather remarkable tree, a banyan tree. I think it's 90 years old, I'm told. The roots hanging down, and in fact, the buildings around here were constructed in order to keep the tree exactly where it is. It's a magnificent structure, and I'm joined by some people a bit younger than the banyan tree, some of the first-time voters here. Perhaps you'll introduce yourselves.
I'm Shreyas. I'm a first-year student, and I'm just 18, so this would be the first time I'll be voting.
I'm Devoshi Datta, 18 too. Going to vote for the first time. Very excited.
Hi, I'm Sanat. I'm 18, and I'm a first-time voter.
I'm Devika. I'm a proud first-time voter studying in St. Joseph's.
So the ladies told me they're excited and proud, so I'm going to start with the ladies. I would have done anyway. But so why are you excited?
I think this is the first time that we will be involved as responsible citizens of the country in a process as big as giving your voice in the democracy. And I think that is a right, of course, but it also gives a little bit of a responsibility on our shoulders to sort of choose who is going to run the government.
So how are you making that choice?
Indian family dinner table conversations about politics is very to-do thing. But as a responsible first-time voter, I think it's more of getting involved in the process to understand how it happens, looking into who is helping out more, who is actually putting in 100% efforts into the whole process would be someone that I would want to vote for.
Pride was a word you used.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I'm an ex-military person's daughter. So being proud to be a citizen of our country means you are a person who are living in the country. So voting is our right. It's our privilege to vote for the people who represent us as a whole. So it's my pride to vote for a country to represent myself.
Well, let's get on to the issues that are important to you. What are you looking at? What are the issues that are important to you in this election?
I am really focusing at a government which will provide employment for me, or the stage where I can showcase my skills, which I am good at.
Because that's quite an issue at the moment for young people, yes, in India, sir, isn't it? Finding jobs.
Jobs, yes. So India basically is a very skillful nation with all the youth. But the problem we are facing is we are not getting the exact stage for the skilled people, skilled labour, so that I can contribute to my nation as well and also be a responsible citizen.
Skills. So is that important for you?
That definitely is important now, being the largest democracy in the world. And definitely it's not possible to cater to literally everyone's needs, but what a government should look forward to after it comes to power should be to definitely cater the needs of most of the people, if not all, so that the true potential of our country can be tapped.
And can I ask what you think of India and where it's going? I mean, you've talked about the issue with skills and jobs. Do you want to stay in India? Do you see your future here? Do you want to travel?
India is a very great country, sir, and I would really like to be here. I would not wish to go to other countries. The coming government, what we are expecting is to provide a stage for us. If that happens, no youth is going to escape from India, and India is going to be a top of the country, sir.
You're nodding.
Yeah, I'm just nodding because I support what exactly he said. I'm an international relations public policy student, so I'll probably move to other country, but just to work for India. So that's a pride in me, and as a country, India is.
That report was by James Kumarasamy. Now, it is hard to imagine the pain of those last few strides at the end of a professional long-distance race, pushing the limits of your body to beat the competition to the finishing line. But what about letting someone win? Well, in China, organisers of the Beijing Half Marathon are investigating allegations that three East African athletes deliberately let China's star runner, He Jie, cross the line before them and win the race. Carrie Allen monitors Chinese media for us.
In state media, you would expect normally for a Chinese star of an event like this that tens of thousands of people took part in to be celebrated. But there is skepticism being shown in newspapers today about video footage that's been shown of what looks like three of these athletes who are winning in the final stages, and they appear to be looking back and waving their hands. And so you've got opinions in newspapers today saying that suspicions are valid and calls for an investigation into this because it could be match fixing.
Yeah, it does, to the untrained eye, look relatively suspicious because they seem to be sort of almost showing him the way to go on the track and then sort of ushering him forwards. Obviously, nothing has been proven to date, but I imagine people in China take sport very seriously, don't they? So they wouldn't want to see one of their athletes winning by nefarious means.
Absolutely. And this has really been a talking point in the last few weeks, because there has been a large scale investigation into corruption and match fixing in football. So there has been talk about how things like this in regards to football, whether they could actually damage the reputation of Chinese people in sport. And so people watching this video footage today, even though they might want to celebrate a Chinese athlete winning this event, they are concerned, and they're saying that they want an investigation to be carried out. This is the talking point on Sina Weibo, which is China's equivalent of a platform like X. People saying that there has to be an investigation into this. And both the marathon partner XStep and the Beijing Sports Bureau have said that they've received feedback in response to this, and they are looking into it, and they will be making a statement in due course.
Very interesting. Is it something you've seen in the past, suspicious things like this?
I have. I can't say I've seen a video like this, though, before. It does look quite suspicious, but it's very difficult to tell. I mean, it's been taken out of context. And yes, it's largely one national newspaper that's reporting on this. But, you know, it's difficult to know when you're running. You know, people make hand gestures and stuff. So yeah, it's very much up to the experts to decide whether this goes further.
Kerry Allen. Still to come.
One star, that star has an audience in Sydney, London, New York, LA. You can take them all over the world on tour and audiences will flock out and you don't need much else.
The new trend that's drawing crowds to the theatre.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, during the COVID pandemic, it was well documented that age was a key factor in how seriously ill infected people became. Older adults were worst hit, whilst children were rarely very ill at all. Well, a new study has revealed why that might be the case. Philippa Roxby is our health reporter.
The nose, I am told, is a virus production factory, and it's the first place where the COVID virus ends up when it goes into the body. And scientists wanted to analyse in detail exactly what happens in real life when that virus gets into the nose. So they looked at nasal cells. These are cells in the lining of the nose, nasal epithelial cells, and they looked at them in petri dishes in the lab. They got volunteers to donate their cells, and then they looked at them over the first few days. They grew them again, so it takes time, analysed them, and then watched what happened when they added coronavirus. And they discovered that actually the picture of the nose cells in young people was very different to the ones in older people. And they reckoned the younger cells, nose cells, were much more protective. The older ones didn't work quite so well.
Are they just more vibrant, more able to cope with the virus?
Yeah, they think that in adults, they saw that there was 100 times more virus in the adult nose. So very quickly, the children's noses were able to fight off the virus somehow. They need to find out exactly how, but it was the balance of cells in their nose. Whereas older noses, aging noses, weren't quite so good at that. The repair mechanism that they had wasn't so good. And so they just ended up with more virus in the nose.
So you've got an old nose, you can't have a nose replacement, your cells are just old.
Yeah.
Why is this information useful, though?
Well, scientists say that might actually help when it comes to looking at treatments and therapies. We shouldn't assume that therapy is going to be the same no matter what age you are for COVID. And so they might need to think about different therapies for older people and different ones for younger people. And they also want to look at other viruses. So, you know, what happens when flu gets into the nose? Does the same thing happen? Or lots of other infections? So there's a lot more work to do, but it's a super interesting finding.
Philippa Roxby. For years, the author Salman Rushdie lived under the threat of violence. In 1988, the Iranian leader Ayatollah Khamenei issued a fatwa against him for his controversial novel, The Satanic Verses. Then, 2 years ago, the threat turned to reality when a man attacked Mr. Rushdie on stage in New York.
Oh my God!
Author Salman Rushdie was attacked.
Author Salman Rushdie attacked.
Rushdie has been stabbed.
There was confusion and panic. The attack happened in full view of the audience, with Sir Salman left injured, lying on stage. and eyewitnesses in deep shock.
But he was stabbed 12 times and he lost his sight in one eye. The suspect, Hadi Matar, was arrested immediately and pleaded not guilty to attempted murder. His trial was postponed because of Rushdie's upcoming memoir about the attack. The award-winning author spoke to Alan Yentob ahead of the book's publication.
I did wonder if somebody was going to jump out of an audience one day. He was dressed in dark clothing and he had a black COVID mask. And he just came sprinting up the stairs to the stage. And when I saw him running, I stood up. I don't know why I didn't fight. And I don't know why I didn't try to escape. But I thought he just punched me very hard. I didn't realise there was a knife in his hand. And then I saw the blood coming out.
Rushdie was airlifted to hospital. With his life in the balance, his wife Eliza never left his bedside.
The room was very eerie and quiet. Salman was just lying there. And I just remember the sounds of the machines and the ventilator breathing for him. It was devastating. When I look at my husband each morning and what's missing, I think of this person who almost took my husband from me.
The first wound was here on the corner of the jaw, as I thought. And then I think he was just slashing wildly at everything across my neck, my forehead, down the middle of my torso is 1, 2, 3, like that. 2 on the side over here and 1 on my thigh over here. At some point, I put up my hand to protect myself, and he stuck a knife in it. And then there was the wound in my eye, which was quite deep, which is why there's no possibility of saving the sight. Language is a way of cutting things open and revealing the truth. And so calling this book Knife is not just a description of the attack against me. The book is the knife, and it's my way of fighting back. It had been 33 and a half years since the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini's notorious death order against me and all those involved in the publication of the Satanic Verses.
When Salman Rushdie seeks repentance, it is incumbent upon each and every Muslim to...
Surely the world had moved on, and that subject was closed. Yet here, approaching fast, was a sort of time traveller, a murderous ghost from the past.
The man accused of carrying out the attack is Hadi Matar from New Jersey. He pleaded not guilty to attempted murder, but is reported to have said he was surprised to hear that Rushdie survived the attack.
There will be a moment when I will be in court with my attacker. I don't know what he would say if he was asked, why did you do it? If I was to write a story in which somebody decided to murder a total stranger on the basis of having read maybe 2 pages of what he'd written and seen a couple of YouTube videos, publishers would say that's not convincing. So it is the most puzzling thing, not only how little he knew about me, but that he didn't seem to feel the need to inform himself. And he just decided that I was disingenuous, which is, it seems to be, not sufficient reason to commit murder.
And he had a bag of knives.
What is that even about? Was he planning to hand them out, ask people to join in? It seems to make no sense at all.
Does this attack suggest that freedom of speech has got more and more difficult rather than less so?
Of speech has got much more difficult, and not just for this kind of reason. A lot of people, including a lot of young people, I'm sorry to say, have formed the opinion that restrictions on freedom of speech are often a good idea. It's now almost okay to be prepared to suppress speech that you don't agree with. Whereas, of course, the whole point of freedom of speech is that you have to permit speech you don't agree with.
You've been through all of this. What about the future?
I think I'm a pretty obstinate person, and I'm going to have my life. When I was lying there on the ground bleeding profusely, I found myself idiotically thinking, oh, that's my nice suit's about to be ruined. And my house keys are in that pocket, which at the time, of course, is ludicrous, but there's an immensely strong survival instinct that human beings have that kicks in, that was saying to me, you're going to live, live, live. And I think that's why I wanted my house keys.
Salman Rushdie speaking to Alan Yentop. When you think of nations where abortion is against the law, the mainly secular, socially liberal Germany probably wouldn't immediately come to mind. But you would be wrong. Abortion is largely illegal there. Now, though, a government-appointed commission has recommended decriminalising it. Damon McGuinness is our correspondent in Berlin.
I think a lot of people outside of Germany and even within Germany could be surprised by the fact that abortions are illegal in principle, but there's an exemption for the first 12 weeks of a pregnancy. Women are allowed to terminate a pregnancy within the first 12 weeks, but only with a consultation, an official consultation with a doctor up to 3 weeks before the procedure. What this means, people who want to liberalise the law say, is that even though women can carry out an abortion or can have this procedure, what happens in reality is there are plenty of barriers. So, for example, the fact that you have to find this consultation, the fact that many doctors and clinics are wary of advertising the fact they carry out an abortion means that it can be hard to find information, some people say, and also that abortions have to be paid privately and not part of the state-regulated free care that people pay for ordinarily. And there can also be a shortage of clinics offering these procedures in certain areas, certainly outside of big cities. So all of this means that the current situation, even though it's possible, it does really put barriers and stress to what can be an already difficult situation for many women. So that's why there has been pressure for a long time to liberalise or to clear up this quite murky situation. And that's what the report today is recommending, to legalise abortions within the first 12 weeks.
And yet there is opposition to that, even legalising it, isn't there?
That's right. And I think particularly from church leaders, some church leaders have been very vocal in the past few weeks. It's become again a big debate here. And the Conservative opposition is also fiercely against changing the law. Some of them say, well, it would open the floodgates to more abortions. And I think what we're seeing is also a concern that this can turn into a politicised issue. So some Conservative opposition MPs are saying, well, the left-wing-led government here is trying to turn this into a culture war ahead of the federal elections next year. That's something the government would deny. But certainly what we're seeing is an increased ferocity around the debate. We've had protests the last few days in certain parts of Germany over this issue. And I think given we've got the fact that there are key elections coming up this year and next year, we could see a more politicised debate around this issue.
Damien McGuinness. Now, with the Barbenheimer phenomenon and other blockbusters, it's been a big year for film and cinema. But what about the world of theatre? Well, at the Olivier Theatre Awards in London on Sunday night, Sarah Snook snatched the award for Best Actress for her one-woman role in Dorian Gray. And it's just one of a number of single-person plays that are now proving to be a big hit. So what's been behind this new trend? The BBC's Michelle Hussein has been speaking to theatre critics Fiona Mountford and Kate Maltby.
This particular trend for solo shows, I think the most important thing to say is that this is about economics. Theatre is still struggling to recover from the COVID crisis. I don't think one can possibly overstate what an existential threat that was. And solo shows are very portable. They're like, I like to compare them to, you know, the Taylor Swift Eras tour. They've got one star. That star has an audience in Sydney, London, New York, LA. You can take them all over the world on tour and audiences will flock out. You don't need much else.
Fiona, what do you think of this trend, this phenomenon?
It's become particularly vibrant in theatre. It's another way of theatre asserting its primacy of the live experience. We watch these actors maybe on our streaming at home, and then we can go to the theatre and actually share the same air, see them live on stage, see it unfold in real time. And that's one of the glories of theatre, and I celebrate anything that draws fresh attention to theatre.
But if more productions go down this route, you have these very famous people in prominent roles, and you don't have the opportunities in an ensemble cast which also develop people.
Well, that's true, but I think we're not going to, I don't think we can say that one person shows are going to wipe out the straight plays and musicals. It's just another facet. And obviously, let us not forget, you've got to have an actor or an actress of a certain status to be able to support these shows. So you couldn't just put any sort of one person in and expect to sell tickets in the West End. So it's got to be a certain level of real star to be able to put these shows on. So I think it's a bit of a self-selecting number of plays that could manage this.
Fiona Mountford and Kate Maltby speaking to the BBC's Michelle Hussein. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X @globalnewspod.
This edition was mixed by Matt Hewitt, and the producers were Alfie Habershon and Jacob Perkins. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.